The opinions expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official positions of the sponsors, advertisers, or presenters. Advertising does not imply endorsement by the sponsors and presenters.
Hey guys, and welcome back to the Lighting Controls Podcast. We have another fantastic guest for you today, but before we jump into the conversation, let me just take a minute to remind everyone that today's episode is presented by the LCA, the Lighting Controls Association.
And it's financially supported by the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, or NAILD. Check out our website, lightingcontrolspodcast.com, where we've got all of our episodes, a news feed, as well as additional resources like a merch store if you want to support the podcast, training events that are happening in the future, as well as information on the new council that Ron and I are starting up with NAILD to try to get more awareness of integration and startup. Additionally, if you're interested in supporting the podcast further than just the merch store, you should click on this link over here or just reach out to us to find out about becoming a sponsor. We'd really appreciate the support. But until then, let's get into the conversation. So today we have Kelly. Kelly, do you mind just giving us a quick breakdown on who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm Kelly Gallagher. So I am a lighting control spec salesperson for Chesapeake Lighting out of the DC metro area. A little bit on my background. I was an IBEW Local 26 electrician in DC for about 4 years. I loved it. You know, the work schedule was heavily 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. And, you know, that put some constraints on regular life. And I started to work on jobs where I was there towards the end, like close to turnover, which is the time to see all of the beautiful light fixtures being installed. You know, installing the final components for controls and actually seeing it programmed and turned over. And that kind of lit a match for me. And so I followed lighting controls as far as I could in the electrical trade until I went ahead over to a manufacturer to do startups and programming. Absolutely loved it, was going to stick with it for a long time. And my best friend actually works at the rep agency that I'm at now. And so he was like, we need a controls person. And you're the only person that I know who knows lighting controls. And of all the people at the agency, like, nobody likes lighting controls. So it's like, okay, this is a good fit. You know, I love lighting controls. I know it from a perspective of installation and of programming, but I don't know this design side and the sales role yet. So, so yeah, that's a little bit on, my career and where I'm at currently. So,
well, thank you so much for joining us. You know, it's really great to hear from somebody who's actually been a part of the installation process. And just for our listeners who aren't familiar with what IBEW is, do you mind just explaining that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. It's the electricians union, at least the big overarching one. Internationally, but primarily here in the States and Canada. And so it provides an excellent program for education and experience on site for those going into the electrical trade. So I highly recommend it. You know, if you have any sort of aspirations to learn more, you know, the IBEW is all about education. They offer courses, which are typically free or very low cost to their members, but others can also join at different costs depending upon what the course is. So yeah, that's the IBEW and they offered an excellent apprenticeship program with all the, you know, going between contractors so that you're well-rounded and you don't get stuck with the same group of guys doing the same type of thing over and over and over again. Nice. So it's like, in my opinion, the best way to learn how to become a great electrician.
Well, I mean, that level of knowledge and experience from that territory, we don't get a lot of exposure to that. So, you know, if you don't mind, I'd like to focus a little bit on that because of the fact that, you know, getting contractors onto the show can be quite challenging. And I know you're not currently a contractor anymore, and we'll definitely get into your work as a rep, but I just want to explore this installation side of things a little bit more because I'm curious what the perspective is on the electrical contractor side when it comes to lighting controls.
Yeah, no, that's Excellent. And I could probably get some contractors who are interested in being on this podcast.
Please. Yeah, no, we'd love to hear.
No, that'd be more. Yeah.
Yeah. I, you know, mark your words. They're quite opinionated.
That's great. We love opinions.
They get pretty passionate about it. So it's good. Yeah. So the perspective of your typical journeyman electrician of lighting controls is, okay, leave that to that guy. He's our lighting guy, you know? So most electricians, at least in, you know, the territory where I'm in, are not total hybrids. You know, you have someone who gets up to the journeyman level and then they begin specializing. So you have your fire alarm journeyman electricians and you have your lighting control journeyman electricians and then the gear and everything else that comes with it. Very few and far between will you find a young journeyman electrician who, yeah, I do it all. You find that sure. A lot of them they specialize. Right. And a lot of the perspectives that I get from electricians are particularly helpful when it comes to documentation, submittals. You know, they're very big on making sure that the submittal has like all of the information needed for them to get through not only the installation, but the commissioning process of when the commissioning agent comes and they want to check everything, that there's no weird assumptions of, oh, this was supposed to do this. Now, having a clear sequence of operations is actually quite important to an electrical contractor because they have something to point to as like, here's the approved submittal that says this room is supposed to do this. So they kind of grow an appreciation of that.
Which is really good to hear. You know, we get a lot of perspective from the specifiers, the designers and the reps when it comes to how to implement sequence of operations, control intent narratives and all of that. But, you know, to actually hear that it's being received quite positively in the field is a really good thing to hear because that means we are moving in the right direction. And we definitely want to create those bridges between the design side and the construction side of projects. And so having these additional resources is what we think is helpful. And to hear that, yes, it is helpful is great. And so
yeah, clarity is key.
What would you say to, you know, designers who are trying to figure this out? Like, what are the core focus points when it comes to documentation?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the key thing that I would hit on is like defining the function of each space. Like it, you know, I think that a control intent narrative and a sequence of operations, like if you can kind of have something in a written form and a chart form and everything just very cohesively explained is helpful. A lot of projects that come across, you know, our inside team, like what they're seeing at their desk is very, very little and very, very loose information. It's, you know, here's reflected ceiling plans and it shows occupancy sensor and switch. And, you know, along with that, we may ask through channels to have, you know, a spec provided, also, you know, sequence of operations, any of that kind of information provided. And oftentimes the specification, like the written specs are very, very generic. And there is no sequence of operation. So it's basically us to determine how that space needs to be put together. And, you know, that just puts us in a role that we don't need to be in, we shouldn't be in. We're, you know, like we can assist in the design process, but we should never spearhead it, unless we're asked by the designer to spearhead it.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Well, and you know, again, that I think that's really great feedback for people to hear. It aligns exactly with the advice that we've heard from various other groups. And it, you know, just kind of coincides with this mindset of a clear control intent narrative wins out over a poor RCP any day. And so you don't necessarily have to show an occupancy sensor right there on the drawing, so long as you clearly identify this space needs an occupancy sensor or occupancy motion detection, and these are the requirements of that motion detection.
Yeah, I honestly like that better, you know, and I think that most people should like it better to not have the drawings all clouded up. but you give something as like an indicator of triangle one means refer to this for this type of room. And, I've seen a lot of electrical engineers starting to move toward that. And I like that a lot. It's a little bit of a learning curve for our inside team because they're looking for the spot and dot indications, but it's really helpful because going from manufacturer to manufacturer based upon what's listed or what we want to go after as like an approved equal or whatnot, we're designing based upon what that manufacturer does well and how they need to do it, as opposed to, oh, well, we could, I guess we can do that. We can try to make a, Cooper look like a Leviton or this, that, or the other. And that's just not ideal.
I'm curious. So when you had those sort of more generic drawings and stuff in the field, and you had to make some assumptions, in those instances where you had a third-party commissioning agent coming out after the fact, if you had a disagreement about the interpretation of those drawings, right? How did you handle that? And then, because if you had one interpretation and the third-party commissioning agent has another, while the lighting designer had a completely different intent in the entire process, how did you sort of work through that on site so that it didn't cost everyone a whole bunch of money?
It didn't. I don't know how it was. The answer is nobody wins. Nobody wins in that scenario because the contractor gets frustrated. They often get spiteful, and they're going to be like, no, the contract drawings, blah, 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 this, and then the commissioning agent says, no, I went over there and I saw this and this other building. And then the designer is just way off in the back already working on 15 other projects. And, they're going to find out about this later when the end user's like, hey, what's going on there? So, yeah. In the end, it's either going to cost somebody a bunch of money, or it's just going to be a lot of unnecessary conflict, if it was just well-defined, in some sort of format, it would have, been avoided entirely. So that's good. So well, I did have a question for you guys. I know this is like off limits on a podcast.
No, we love questions.
I'm the guest. But we've had
guests who just grill us the entire time, and it's great. We love it.
Yeah. So as I consider myself more of a rookie and you guys more of the veterans. So I want to hear from your perspective, architectural lighting controls, whether it's residential, commercial, industrial, whatever. What do you see as like the maybe one or two biggest sticking points or biggest issues in lighting controls that you either are seeing resolved or would like to see resolved? I have some in my head, but I'm interested to see what you guys have to say to that.
Ron, do you want to go first?
No, go ahead. You go because okay. I have a funny feeling they're going to be exactly the same.
They probably are. I would say the biggest sticking point really is education. We're really great at generating content, but we're not great at disseminating that content and sharing it with people who are not in this bubble, essentially. So we've got from your perspective, it's always, I really appreciate that you think of me as an expert, but I think there's this sort of like ivory tower experience with the experts of lighting controls where it's like, oh, they know way more than me. There's no way I'm going to reach their level of knowledge. And it's like, the only reason I'm where I'm at with knowledge is because I'm curious and I do dig really, really hard into like the really nauseatingly boring stuff at times. And so, right. There's some great resources out there if you know how to read them. There are some awful resources out there if you don't know how to read them. And yes. So we really need to do a better job educating and getting people elevated in their knowledge of lighting controls, and not just, the professionals, but the end users, everybody involved needs to be elevated in their knowledge and capabilities. And so that's really the big sticking point for me. What about you, Ron?
Yeah, so it's that, and then it's interoperability between devices, right? And I understand systems are proprietary, and that's not likely going to change anytime soon. Software is going to be proprietary to that specific system. What we need is interoperability between devices. You As an owner should be able to, when a device fails, a motion sensor, a switch, they should be able to, I understand it doesn't happen right now, but they should be able to grab a switch from another system, put it in, and they should be able to program it. And that is part of what makes Dolly very attractive to people, right? Is the fact that you can grab manufacturer A's switch, manufacturer B's sensor, and do what you need to do. And that needs to start making its way through some other systems. And not just interoperability within the lighting systems, but we need to start thinking bigger picture. We need to effectively work with building operating systems. We need to work with HVAC. We need to work with the, you know, the utility. Everything needs to come together because the rebates are no longer in the lighting. LEDs are king. Everyone already knows that. We're seeing that, right? That's what we heard from the DLC. Lighting rebates, gone. See you, bye. Controls rebates are what we're going to start seeing moving forward. So if LEDs have already hit that peak, well, now we need to start thinking bigger than that. And it really does come down to controls and being able to talk to more than just the lighting system.
Right. Yeah, no, definitely agree. I going back on the educational point, you know, I think that, you know, you kind of hit it, Webster, of like, not just the professionals need to understand lighting controls. I think that a better job can be done as far as educating those installing the control system and those programming the lighting control systems. And I think a really good opportunity for that, you know, I mentioned the IBEW earlier. You know, I'm somewhat still connected with my local chapter, and you know, they're very open to having others like come in to educate. Like right now, our local 26 classroom instruction, they do have a lighting controls class, but their lighting controls class is on one particular manufacturer.
Got it.
And so that's where I was like, you know, maybe we should look at some other folks coming in to, you know, provide a course that, you know, maybe hits it in a more generic sense, or looks at six manufacturers and goes through and interprets, you know, how to read a submittal and how to install a system based off of that. I could see that being a really good way to educate the segment of installation. I think the education resource through the LCA and doing the CLCP and the classes associated with that, I'm like three quarters of the way through it, and it's already kind of blown my mind. I was like, what more can I learn about lighting controls? And I get one or two of those things in, and I'm like, I've already learned so much on lighting controls. I was a little humbled by that, you know. But yeah, that it, and the end users as well, I think that it's very common for end users and engineers and everyone on like that part of the design team to say, just give us the minimum, give us what we need for lighting controls. We don't care. And so not seeing the value of, you know, I've looked at a few stadiums, programmed some stadiums in the past, and just the concept of I can go to an iPad and just use my little finger to touch a button, and then I just turned on like 800 amps worth of lighting.
Right.
Like, I think that's insane. You know, the guy at his house, you know, if there's any sort of issues, can log into his iPad and control lights, or, you know, that person in their office that has a headache that day can dim down lights by 10% and make it a more pleasant experience for them. So I think that, you know, there just needs to be more of like a value seen with lighting controls from the end user perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And touching on the, sorry, go ahead.
No. You were
stepped down off the podium for 3 seconds. I was gonna kind of touch more on the interoperability side of things, and I mean how neat that would be. One of the biggest issues I think with lighting controls is the maintainability, and I think that's where interoperability really comes into play. Of, you know, if I have this manufacturer's switch, and say for example, water damage because a pipe broke in my facility. You know, it can't be an insurance claim because it was kind of our building's fault, and it's just a replacement of one device. And, you know, that switch may be $150, $200, whatever it is. And then you have 6 weeks later, a field service technician from whatever manufacturer coming in charging you know, $2,000+ to program that one switch. And all of a sudden, you know, you have one switch that once upon a time was a toggle switch that you could have picked up at Home Depot for $2. Now it's a $2,500 problem. And so that's where it kind of, I think, leaves a sour taste in the mouth of the end user to consider a lighting control system that is, you know, advanced and provides all these additional features. Because to them, it's like, it's a huge liability now in comparison. So having a system that's maintainable and interoperable is kind of, that's, well, that is a key.
I think that that's a really good point too, just to expand upon, you know, maintainability, because one of the phrases that I like to say about lighting controls is it's a living, breathing entity and it needs to be maintained. You can't just buy it and then leave it alone for 20 years and expect it to function just the same. You know, I think the idea that was presented with LEDs is, well, it's forever, you know, you don't need to replace LEDs anymore. And so with that came this mentality of, well, lighting controls for LEDs are also forever. But from your perspective, you know, what's the best way to make sure that maintainability is on a project?
I mean, that can be, you know, from the specification side of like written in the specifications of, you know, the end user has the ability to, you know, if a device goes bad, to have that device installed and then program it to get it back into the system. It needs to be something that's as user friendly as that. And for a lot of systems, that's a really, really high and lofty goal. For some systems, it's not. So I think a lot of manufacturers need to step it up as far as like, okay, the programming and the long term 5, 10, 15 years down the road view of this needs to be, hey, you know, facility manager X needs to go and be able to maintain their own systems programming. So I think a simplicity side of it is incredibly important. Or, you know, a system where you can replace parts and components without reprogramming necessary. So that could be another aspect there. But I think it has to come from the specification. And manufacturers need to step up and get themselves up to par with that.
Yeah. So I will. All right. So two things. One, yes, systems where you can say this device is switch 32 and it just works, is that's the easiest way to handle it. Right. Because there's no reprogramming. It just, this device pulls its information from the network and it now knows what it is and it does what it needs to. That is the easiest way to handle this, because to play devil's advocate, we can train whatever end user we want. We can train the maintenance guy. And in 3 years, when that maintenance guy leaves, the building almost never retrains somebody new. So now you had someone who was trained on the software as part of the spec package, right? They got the software, they got a laptop or whatever. They were trained. That person leaves. Yeah. No one's now trained. Now here we are 5, 10 years down the road, and we've got the same problem all over again. So it's, right. I don't disagree that it needs to come from the spec side, but building owners also need to take some responsibility for the systems, because unfortunately, we're just not there yet where we can truly make it as simple as replace a switch in a wall and it just works. And until we get there, everyone kind of has to play a role in this.
Yeah. So it sounds like we need to invent a Dolly system that has physical address dials on it. That's what it sounds like to me. So we'll work on that this afternoon.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also just the serviceability of parts in general.
Yes.
You know, sometimes you would void the warranty on a fixture by opening it up and taking the driver out. So that serviceability is a challenge. Additionally, there are parts and pieces of a control platform that might go poorly and need to be replaced. Who's doing the labor of that replacement work? So there's a lot of layers to this that, yeah, I can write a spec, and a lot of the designers right now are screaming in my ears saying, you know, what the heck is this? But, you know, yeah, you can write a line that says, this is what I want.
Yeah.
But a lot of manufacturers would probably be like, they're never going to get that. And so, you know, personally, I think that's where integrators and dealers get involved to support the project and say, we have a service plan. We will service your system for you. And I know a lot of reps are also doing that too, offering integration services or maintenance services. And even contractors are starting to talk about creating service plans with the projects that they're doing so that should something go bad, they're there to support the project. But I think, you know, to your point, you still need to specify it, but the infrastructure also needs to be there to support that specification. And so, you know, the old adage of, if you don't specify it, it's wishful thinking. That's definitely one way to approach it. I think if you don't have the infrastructure to support the specification, it's also wishful thinking. So it is sort of this dual route, this dual path approach to it that we need to focus on. But furthermore, I would say that that's an educational thing more than anything. But it is sort of education supporting maintenance and ongoing services. So getting to your new day job, being as a rep, so they pulled you in because they needed a controls guy and you were the controls guy they knew. You know, what is, you know, we've talked to several controls specialist reps out there, but it seems to vary by territory. And so I'm curious, you know, what is the landscape of the DC environment?
Yeah, it's a lot of government projects, which means there's a lot of specifiers that hate the idea of wireless. so that's one of my constant daily battles is, okay, I mean, you don't want wireless, that's fine, we can go with a good wired system, but you know, it's constantly something that I'm trying to break away at, just for the sake of you know, just opening up that field to government related projects.
Well, what are the common issues or questions that you get when it comes to wireless?
The common issue question that I get has to do with, well, somebody can just hack into that then, you know, like somebody can, you know, pick up on that Bluetooth frequency and get in and control the lights. And even if you show them, like, you know, this is not touching your network in any capacity, it's still a concern to them that somebody can come in and alter their light levels. So that's typically where it's a stopping point there. Cause it's like, okay, that can happen. You know, I'm not going to lie to you and say that that cannot happen. You know, somebody much savvier than me can hack into any of these wireless systems and be able to control your lights. And so that's typically how the conversation goes. I also get weird conversations about, like, you know, dual technology sensors, like they're listening to you, picking up on conversations, like what it's actually like, you know, measuring, you know, like if you were to make one of those dual tech sensors a microphone, and that would be the microphone I use for this podcast, you would have no idea what I'm saying at all. It'd be just like, nothing. It'd just be beeping.
Well, and that's if you're using an acoustic style dual tech. If you're using an ultrasonic dual tech, you're not picking up anything that's on the human level.
Yeah. So even that is, that's a funny conversation that's typically had. With government clients, they want to hear that everything is Buy American compliant, made in the United States. And they want it wired and not touching their network in any capacity. That's typically that. But that doesn't consume all of my work. You know, there's the typical commercial office spaces, education. We do a lot of data centers where we're at as well, because Northern Virginia, which is within our territory, is like the data center capital of the world. So the most boring concrete block buildings for miles and miles and miles, with the most simple lighting and, you know, 70 CRI interior fixtures and nothing pretty, nothing exciting about them. They're just humongous. And there's way too many of them, but yeah, primarily, you know, my goal is to call on electrical engineers and, lighting designers. And, I'm very thankful for, you know, the team that I have around me, because, they've really just kind of introduced me to so many people in the market that are just fantastic to work with that, you know, want to really pull us into the project so that we can provide, you know, an in-depth level of involvement. And I just find that portion of it so enjoyable, where I can, you know, come up with ideas and present it to them and be like, you know, if receptacle load control is a huge occupant discomfort thing, you know, and we're often seeing that, you know, in the DC metro area, we have like a green energy code that requires receptacle load control in offices, classrooms, conference rooms, open offices, that kind of stuff. And along with IECC 2021 starting to be more heavily adopted in Maryland, we're starting to see more and more of that. And so trying to like pose some creative solutions to make it so it's not as much of a hindrance to the occupant. So, you know, utilizing time clock events to disable the occupancy sensor controls for the plug loads during their regular business hours has been one that has, you know, we've gotten approved and whatnot. But that's just like a small example of like, okay, here's some input I have. You know, would you guys want to talk with DC about this to see if they would accept it? And then, you know, it's just a fun process overall, getting to kind of brainstorm a job and then see it come to fruition as well. And we have in-house technicians that program our systems and service our systems. So it's really neat to be involved, like from the specification, and our inside team is handling all of the, what I call the nasty side of dealing with distributors. And then once it's actually out and being installed, our team supporting it and training the contractor and then programming it and then training the end user. So I get a unique glance of seeing the whole process of that, which has been very enjoyable.
So was the issue with the plug loads, was that specifically that while the building was occupied, someone would get up, leave their office to go to the bathroom or do this, they'd come back and their computer was off or their devices were no longer charging because the plug loads had turned off on them?
Yeah, so it came from two directions. One, the end user. So the first thing is that, you know, when they notice that their plug is turning on and off on them, what has been happening since 2017 when this was implemented in DC is, you know, office workers picked up on this and they would plug, you know, extension cords or power strips into the switch that was not going to turn off on them. And then what happened on the power distribution side is the panels are no longer balanced because all of the load is going to, you know, my odd circuits and my even circuits, which were used for control, are being unused. And so that's affecting, you know, transformers on the power distribution side, causing harmonic dissonance, which, you know, is inducing heat on the neutral wires and everything. Yep. So, and then premature failed equipment on the power distribution side. So that was a few studies have been conducted in our territory, and I've spoken with a few of the engineers who were a part of that case study. And so one of my projects was with one of those engineers. So it was interesting.
You just threw a ton of big words at our listeners. I love this kind of level of deep dive. I just want to make sure that our listeners are following along because, you know, harmonic dissonance is like, what the heck is that? But basically what's happening is because of the fact that energy code requires like 50% of receptacles to be switched via a motion sensor or some other automatic feature, the office users have become savvy to this and started bypassing that by just putting an extension cord or another strip so that they could just plug into the always on plug. But because of the way that the power is often created for these spaces, you're often doing that switching based on the breakers, the legs of the breakers, and the way that the power is distributed, it can create an unevenness in how there's basically three phases feeding into the building. And if those phases are not balanced at least approximately the same, you can get really bad results and damage equipment and even cause, like, you know, stuff to overheat, like you were saying. So as a result, you know, this behavior that we've kind of engineered is a real problem, because the goal was not to tell people use only the always on power. The goal was basically say only switch the non-important loads. Like if you have a laptop, it's fine if it switches off because you're going to leave it alone for a while. But, you know, even there, it's just sort of like, what is the goal here? We're trying to save energy and people are finding ways to bypass that.
Yeah. And our mission was to make receptacle load control in this particular building unnoticed. And so that's where, okay, now instead of typically having all of our private offices as standalone, now we're actually having our private offices and every area across the project being on the lighting control network, so that we can program time clocks and all of that stuff. So that, you know, and this is a big thing where, you know, typically you're not allowed to bring space heaters in and stuff like that. But what happens in every single building I've ever been to that I've, you know, been alongside for an energy audit is you walk into an office, it's blazing hot, there's nobody in there, no lights are on, nobody's been in there all week, and there's a space heater running. So that's where it's like, okay, well, if we disable this during the daytime and it only turns on, you know, like if there is occupancy picked up, like at the beginning of the day, then we can cause a scenario where, okay, they may plug their unauthorized space heater into their controlled receptacle. And when they're not there after they leave home for the day, it will turn off and it's not going to come back on until they come into the office on Monday or Tuesday the following week. So that was like, okay, let's think about this in light of what we've seen and propose a solution that, you know, may not be perfect, but be a bit better.
So, yeah, well, and I think, you know, that's really interesting, you know, to think about using conditional logic in that way, because not all manufacturers have the ability to do conditional logic like that. But the ones that can do that, I think, you know, those sorts of applications are fantastic. I love those sorts of things, because it's like you're actually thinking through and providing a custom programming solution for the need of the project. And so that's really awesome to hear about. And I think, you know, this is going on to the territory of one of the questions Ron and I always ask, which is, you know, who should be in charge of the lighting controls design? And I would say that this is an argument for the reps to do that, because, you know, this is a phrase that a colleague of mine gave me a long time ago, but the rep is the glue that holds the project together, and who better to provide that solution than the glue?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as a rep, very biased, I'm going to agree. but I would still say that, you know, the design, you know, if there's a lighting designer involved, we're seeing a lot more lighting designers in our territory being very heavily involved with the lighting controls in a very thoughtful manner. And that's been really exciting to see. It's a bit of a learning curve for some, as we've noticed, because, you know, it's a new thing to them. Not all of them though. Some of them, you know, I know of, a good, you know, mutual friend of ours, Webster, Ben Sullivan at CM Kling, he is their lighting control designer.
Right.
And so it's really neat to see the design firms that are taking lighting control seriously to that level of like, nah, you know, just give us the minimum. We don't care about lighting controls. So like, oh no, we care about lighting controls. Let's actually, maximize the value and not hurt ourselves here. But yeah, I think the design team still needs to take the charge in that and then depend upon the reps as well. You know, if they can kind of pass off some of the duty to us and then just interact with us, make sure that we've dotted all our I's, crossed all our T's. Those have been the best scenarios. You know, that's how you get to doing things like lumen maintenance dimming with a service plan. You know, that's not typically thought of, you know, from the start of a project when you're in concept pictures and stuff like that. But think about just the level of value that's delivered by saying, okay, no, we're going to, you know, have the lighting well coordinated with the controls. We're going to have it go to no more than 80% output. We're going to run all our calcs at 80% output. And then over the course of 5 years, we're going to take light level readings, and then we're going to actually increase the output based upon what you need. And it's going to, you know, increase the life of your luminaires, you know, and really take advantage of the control system that you have. So that's another one of those educate the end users. Here's something that's, is something we couldn't do before. You know, there's no way to do that before, but now we have a way to do that, which is really unique.
And additionally, it goes along the lines of make sure that you have that clarified early on so that, you know, it's expected and understood that that's going to need to happen.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But if that can be thought of and started to implement during the actual design process, that's, you know, then it's locked in and we're of the perspective that, oh, we can do that. Think about the value that's being delivered there.
Nice. So I am curious. I do want to circle back to one thing. I'm very curious, having the field experience that you have, how has that helped your relationship with designers and stuff, being from the rep agency where you go to a designer or to an engineer and they start talking about the system and you can talk about the practical side and tell them that, you know, that's a great in theory, but in practice, this isn't going to work quite the way you think it is. And how has that helped that relationship and trust between you as the rep with those other entities?
Yeah, it's definitely helped them to depend on me for reliable, like, schematic understanding of things. Like, here's how everything is piecing together. But, you know, those high and lofty goals and design, you know, they all have implications. I mentioned the project where every single private office is on the network. Every single private office has conditional logic. You know, I was consulting with our, you know, the factory and our field team who programs these systems and just getting their input because I knew that there would be, you know, an increased level of programming. It's probably going to take three times as long and take, you know, two technicians to be on site or three technicians at sometimes just to make sure that the project is being delivered on time. And so with that, you know, being very clear of like, there is going to be an added cost for doing this. But we may see a huge benefit if you think that, you know, cost comparison here, that this is going to be worth it. So I think helping them manage expectations on a more like programming and installation side has been pretty helpful. I've also had a number of instances where there's something talked about in design development and then, you know, it kind of hits my ear as a little bug and I'm like, let me push back on this just a little bit here. So, you know, cause I've, well, you know, I've installed, you know, some pretty crazy fixtures before and, you know, I can just see like issues with, okay, how are we going to mount this? Are you going to find the cord drop and an aircraft cable that can span 30 feet here and then surface mount over here and all this stuff, when it comes to that. And then, yeah, on the control side of things, just in the review, I often come across a few things where I can kind of cue in the electrical engineer and provide some additional input where respectful and where necessary, of course. So,
Yeah, well, of course. And but again, you know, it goes along the same lines of where the majority of people we interview say, like, you know, get me involved early. I don't care if it's a 5-minute meeting. Mm-hmm. It's just like, get me to speak on this. But we're almost out of time here. So I want to encapsulate what we've discussed here. It's really cool stuff. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story because it would love to have more contractors come on. So, you know, if any of our listeners know of anybody who wants to be on the show, if you know of anybody who wants to be on our show, please, you know, let us know, send them our way. But I mean, basically, you know, you come from this installation background with the IBEW. And from that perspective, you know, there is a lot of challenges to the installation process of lighting controls. And we are getting better on the design side of providing thorough documentation that's clear enough for installers to follow. Mm-hmm. But there still is that disconnect that's happening. And in a lot of cases, there's still vague RCPs that just kind of allude to what is expected, but not actually giving strict guidance or performance expectations for the project. And so you, as an installer, had to guess what was being implemented. Whereas as a rep, you know, your current job, you really have a better opportunity to step in and at earlier on in the project and say, okay, you know, here's what I'm hearing. This is what we can offer to provide the solution for you regarding that. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of hesitation with certain technologies such as wireless, especially in government buildings and as it pertains to cybersecurity. But you know, that seems to be an ongoing discussion as it is. And I don't know if we'll ever get to a point where we can, you know, definitively say we're done talking about this. I think it's always going to be a topic of discussion. But I think, you know, you bring up really good points about air gapping your system so that it's not touching another system. Not all wireless systems are Bluetooth. So if Bluetooth is a debate topic, it might be a different protocol that you want to use. But regardless, you know, there's still a lot of hesitancy for that adoption. And so wired, when it comes to government buildings especially, you know, is the standard for lighting control solutions. And so I think anybody who any brands out there that are all wireless are unfortunately getting eliminated from that solution in a lot of cases, which is sad, because I think the technologies that are out there, there's always great resources from all of the brands that are out there and are definitely worth considering. But, you know, from your perspective, having that seat at the table early on at least helps you be a part of that conversation and help facilitate, you know, this sort of approach to conditional logic, which is a programming style that is useful to making sure that, you know, if then criteria is met, you know, if somebody walks into the room and it's during business hours, then this will happen. So that's really powerful programming capabilities that a lot of brands do offer in our industry. And it's worth thinking through and coming up with those custom solutions for projects. And then tying back to the questions that you asked us, I think, you know, part of it is that we really need to do a much better job of educating. And I think, you know, if any educators listening to this are interested in getting involved with IBEW or any other groups that are out there that are reaching out to the builder groups or end user groups, you know, I think this should be your charge to try to take action and get involved. But then also interoperability is a big deal and maintenance is a big deal. And, you know, all of this is just really important stuff for us to be focusing on as an industry. But did I miss anything in my recap?
I don't think you did. that was a
awesome,
nice, dense recap there. Good job.
Well, thank you. But awesome. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think this whole perspective here that we have, you know, it really is a team effort. And so having people from different perspectives in new roles or just continuing to do their same role, but thinking outside of their role to the other groups is really how we're going to succeed here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And one last thing, just as like an advisement for reps and what we've seen even recently is I think in our history, you know, as my rep agency in particular, there was a time where we were just focused on winning jobs, you know, and it wasn't a matter of like, were we a good fit for the job? And so, you know, for controls, it was a long-term sticking point for us where, you know, maybe we didn't make the best reputation for ourselves because we were going after every project just to, you know, just to get on it. And so making sure that whatever you put out is going to be something that should be there, you know, is key. And being very involved with the specifiers, like the inside team, you know, as a practice is constantly reaching out to me that say like, hey, should we quote this? We're not listed. It's like, maybe we shouldn't on this one. I can go out to speak with that specifier, but unless they're saying, okay, we'll accept equals. If you come, you know, discuss with us, let's not touch it. You know, let's not harm our relationships, and let's not put us out there as doing something that we should not be doing. It's going to bite us in the end. So we've definitely seen doing right by our specifiers and making sure that whatever we're putting together for a project is, you know, a good solution that meets the design intent, that serves us in the end. And it helps our specifiers, our contractors, distributors to know, like, no, we do right. We do the right thing by our clients. And, you know, we're not just a hungry agency trying to get after every single project that we have no business getting after. Let's just do right by our clients, and it'll come back to us. So,
yeah, no, that's great to hear. And it goes a long way too with the having a clear scope and a design intent, mm-hmm. and having that narrative and having those drawings, because it's a lot easier if you have proper documentation to figure out if you are the right fit or not, right? Which will alleviate mm-hmm. some of the issues we've seen in the past, because, you know, people will know, you know what? No, our solution's not the best fit for this, given this intent narrative. So it is good to hear. And, you know, you hammered home the same thing that we say all the time with education, but you kind of took it a step further in that it really does take a village on these projects. No one person has all the answers, right? We all look at it from different angles. So getting an entire team of people involved sooner is really going to be only a benefit to the project, because if you have all the interested parties, all the stakeholders together, you know, if the contractor's on board, the rep is on board, the design team's on board, the engineer, everyone is working together that's on the project, you'll make sure that you eliminate any potential holes and gaps within the control system and really deal with things early on. So it really does take a team to put together a cohesive project and make sure that things go smoothly. And then, like you mentioned and Webster mentioned, if people are, you know, it's great to hear that, you know, the local IBEW is looking for those resources and looking to get more education for people. If anyone from the 103 is listening, Webster and I are both in Boston, and I know a lot of the 103 guys know both of us. So if anyone from 103 is listening, reach out. We'd love to have that conversation.
Absolutely.
We'd love to have you on the show too, but we'd love to have that conversation. If we can assist in providing you some of those resources, even if it's not us, we have connections to the right people. We can certainly help put you in touch. So Kelly, absolutely fantastic conversation. Like, really appreciate your time, your perspective on everything. You know, having sort of seen both sides as a contractor and as the rep, it's great to sort of get that perspective and get that understanding from you and see how things are slightly different in the DC metro area mm-hmm. than they are here in the Boston area. So really, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you both. This has been great.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. I just want to take a minute to remind everyone today's episode was presented by the LCA, the Lighting Controls Association.
And it's financially supported by the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, or NAILD. Check out our website, lightingcontrolspodcast.com. We've got all of our episodes, a news feed, a merch store, trainings that Ron and I might be doing, maybe for IBEW or not. but, you know, additionally, we've got our council that we're starting up on startup and integration services. And finally, if you want to support the podcast in a real way, we would really appreciate sponsors who want to be a part of this dialogue and get involved. So please reach out to us if you want to be part of this. But until then, thank you so much for joining us. And Kelly, thank you as well. Really awesome conversation.